Then even without the millennium change, I have a problem. I changed them. Yeah. You're always the problem. Well, can other people get your
I'd like to call the session back to order. If Scott Bradner would take his seat. Ji Liang, if you would take your seat, please. Charles Nesson, if you could take your seat. Yes. If members of the Membership Advisory Committee could take a seat up at the front, you should know who you are. Ready to reconvene. Can the members of the Membership Advisory Committee to ICANN please join us up at the front? We thought it would be nice if they had a chance to have some position here, having come as far as many of them have, to ask some questions as the presentations unfold. Are there other members of the Membership Advisory Committee here? Esther, you're a member, as I recall. There's some, yes. All sort of members are welcome as well. And as they take their seats, reiterate that there is a reception at Charles Nesson's house, for which we have not only provided a map on the screen for 2 seconds, but runoff copies, courtesy of our sponsor of this map, Yahoo Maps. And you'll see a route delineated in a dotted line, how to get there if you're walking, and another line, how to get there if you're driving, which is about 4 times as long, given Cambridge's notorious one-way street system. So these are available both downstairs, and we'll have them over at the table over here, and that reception will be just after we close this session. Also, somebody appears to have left a parking ticket at the moderator's podium.
That's Jason. I agree on it.
Yes, but you left it for me to deal with. So what we'll do now over the next 30 minutes or so is hear reports from the three respective workshops, and hopefully the moderators themselves, or they designated somebody to give the reports for each of the workshops, and have the members of the Membership Advisory Committee have a chance to ask questions as those unfold as well. So with that said, why don't we start actually with breakout session one, who is or should be a member of ICANN. Tamar Frankel was running that session. Where is Tamar? Great.
Do I do it from here? I can do it from here. I wish I could report that we came with a real breakthrough of a very clear design that everybody would applaud immediately. Didn't happen. So, however, what we did come with, I think are the main concerns. And with some feel of where we might go, the main concern is that the at-large directors ought to represent users, that the users ought to be represented. That was kind of quite clear from the discussion. Now, the question was really how would that best be achieved, and some thought that the best way was simply to have one user, one vote, individuals only, simple, and the end of it. However, there were some arguments against it. Users are not always willing to invest the time. If we add associations, and in that I include both membership associations, corporations, and business associations, and professional associations, in other words, association of every kind, they have a higher stake than all users, not than some users, but than all users. They will be more, quote, activist members, and therefore will lend more stability to the outcome, which is the board, at least the 9 members of the board. And that would lead to a suggestion that these organizations should be members as well. Other reason would be that individuals may not have the ability or the interest to directly be involved in the election or in the arguments about policy matters of ICANN. On the other hand, they could do it much more effectively through an organization that is also going to speak in 1,000 voices rather than one. And so that these kinds of organizations may serve them better. And therefore, I can't say that there was a full consensus, but at least there was serious consideration to having both individuals and organizations of a variety of sorts as members of ICANN with voting rights. And then it became clear that both individuals and some organizations, even large user organizations, may not have an interest to be fully active members, but they may have an interest in receiving information and also in having a kind of standing to say, not merely to say what they think in an op-ed or on the internet, but also to say something to the board and expect some kind of a response. And so these are not voting members, but they are speaking members, yes, who want to have their voice heard in more than the usual form. And we saw some organizations of this kind thinking that maybe we could classify them, although how to classify them becomes a really difficult problem. There was a suggestion that perhaps, well, on one hand we could have, it's wonderful we can have a lot of hands, on one hand we can have the one big pool, everybody just simple structure. You have a pool of voters and that's the end of it. On the other hand, there was also a suggestion of classes, classifying the board members and then allocating number of board members to each type of organization, including a type of individual. There was also a concern that if you do that, you may have organizations that will have a double vote, both through SOs and through directly on the board. On the other hand, the same applied to individuals if they are members of SOs and they are members of organizations and they are members in their own individual rights. So concern was that the moment you offer a more complex design, you have double, triple, maybe quadruple votes, and the question was, is that justifiable? May I interject now? It just occurred to me this moment, and I'm not very, maybe I'm not doing the right thing, but maybe if somebody is sufficiently energetic to go and collect these double, triple, quadruple votes, maybe they should be viewed as more activist. I don't know. One last, which I considered very important subject and turned out to be discussed shortly, but with quite a sense of consensus, was the question of flexibility. I think everybody kind of thought and took heed of Scott Bradner's comments on once you choose the wrong structure, you're stuck with it. Very difficult then to review it and revise it and change it. And so there were ideas about the need for a clear method of revisit and revise. And second, a notice of what that method is going to be. And a suggestion that you start a process of revision immediately as a matter of course, and that the default rule may be not that we must change what is, but we must reaffirm what is. And if we don't reaffirm, then something else must come in its place. And that is a more powerful drive that affects the kind of tendency to repeat what we've done and justify it rather than look at it critically.
Thank you. Tamar, I'd like to just open it up to the panel to see if you've got a question. I'm sorry, you wanted to do some kind of other report, you say? No, I'd rather open it up to the panel, and then if we have a moment, we can hear a minority report.
The special voice? I didn't hear that.
I'm sorry.
One of the proposals is people who want a special voice but don't want to vote. I don't understand that concept.
You can view a very general power to vote for those who control ICANN. Yes, that's one level. But then you may have people who are not really interested in that, but have particular issues, special issues. They would like not only to have a voice simply by putting their concerns on the internet, or even writing to the board, but having some entitlement for a response by the board. Standing to say to the board, please listen to us, yes? And this is what I really meant, didn't articulate, yeah?
How do you see that scaling up?
How do I see that?
How do you see that scaling up in the sense that if 100 people write each week, let's face it, then the board can answer them. If 2,000 people write each week, it's going to end up being the staff that answer them and that perform triage on these things. And so how do you deal with it?
Well, we didn't deal with it, but we have mechanisms to, first of all, generalize. If the 2,000 people all have one issue, that's easy. Yes, that, as a matter of fact, what that means is that this is an issue which we must really address somehow.
I agree with you absolutely. How do those people be assured that in fact their voice, I mean, in practice, they go on their own website and they create enough fuss that somebody notices them.
Right.
Is there any formal process you want to make sure that that happens?
You could have that, and I think we've been dealing with a review board, as a matter of fact, even with a bifurcated review board, one which is internal to ICANN board, and that is for someone, either one or three members of the board, reviewing a summary, sure, a summary of these complaints and determining either that they have substantial merit, in which case the full board ought to look at it. If they don't have substantial merit, then there is a question of whether they can be revised or not.
Just as a question of attitude, let's call them possibly constructive suggestions, maybe not even complaints.
Go into the, I'm sorry.
I don't hear you.
Would that be different from what goes into the internal review process?
No, it would not be. This is the internal review. The other is an external review by, say, people who have sat on high courts and have retired. But their mission should be more independent on the one hand, but more legal and less business-oriented on the other hand. They should not revise the business decisions of the board, but they may revise the authority, the extent of the authority, the interpretation of the authority, and so on. That's, I think, what is emerging. Yeah.
Tamar, in the model where organizations can be members, what was the discussion or consensus, if any, about the weight of the organization's vote? One vote per organization, or a weighted vote, or organizations can be members but can't vote?
There was no consensus, and we didn't go in depth into it, but the one organization, one vote was not totally acceptable. On the other hand, to count the membership within the organization is, of course, a very difficult issue. And the question is also whether an organized group of people should trump one individual who has a gripe and who has a good, well, has a good judgment. That's the minority process. And then that led to some kind of suggestion about classification of board members, but then we got again back into the question of weighting the votes.
Was there any discussion that you could be an organization, be a member, but have no vote?
Yes. Yes, that was one, that there are some organizations, that was an observation, that there are some organizations that are not really interested in the vote so much as they are interested in a particular issue that they would like to be discussed at great length and to be heard. Yes.
Or this may be simply the SOs versus the at-large membership, but some notion of a bicameral system where you have a group of orgs and you have a group of individuals, and whether that's they're both part of the at-large or they end up being the SOs and the at-large separately.
Yes.
Jimmy, I thought you...
Haven't you discussed about the fees for individuals as well as organizationals, as well as some geographic proportion or what?
We started with, there was one suggestion in which all members should be just chambers of organizations that belong to a particular region and nothing else, no individuals at all except through the particular chamber. There were arguments against that. One was that it doesn't, that there is kind of a limited view then of the world, which is counteractive to the internet, which views the world as a whole. So this was one. Also, there was concern about interests that may control these chambers and control the choices of these chambers, especially in developing countries. I don't think, that's my sense, and I hope I'm correct, that this proposal was kind of received, especially as we went into other permutations. There's always a question of the balance between simplicity and complexity and how complex can we go. But this was not really an acceptable suggestion.
To provide a complementary view, I think one of the issues that was discussed between high involvement members and low involvement members was maybe voting and non-voting rights, or maybe everybody voted, but different levels of actual participation to decisions, elaboration, appeals, etc. So maybe every member could vote, but they would have different levels of implication, including, but maybe not only, within SOs.
Great. Thank you very much, Tamar. How I'd like to proceed is to, given it's now 3:07, I'd like to hear from the other two groups, and then if they're with the questions answered, and then if there are comments, we'll fit them in. And I promise, Jay, at least 2 minutes at the end of this, no matter what happens, however late we run, to deliver whatever comment you'd like to deliver. Well, there'll be one now and then many later. I'd rather save until the end. Yes, although fairness may be a zero-sum game, but to be overly fair...
I'm now learning about capture.
Jay, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to report that I attempted to go to the pre-lunch determination of what might be the field of discussion, and I said I would represent the position that countries should be members, and I was told that was out of bounds of that discussion. It could not be a position that would not be tolerated by the moderator on the basis that the white paper doesn't allow that. And my understanding of that is that's the mechanism of capture by the U.S. government of the process. So by accepting that imposition of a constraint, I was not able to participate in that, and I thought I had something to bring to it. So I left that one and went to another one and tried to participate on a basis that I could.
Thank you. Your point is taken, and let's just be sure, is the way the scribe has it represented properly as far as you're concerned, for the record? Okay. Thank you. Can we now go to threats and countermeasures for capture and the corresponding possibilities of liberation from that group? Have we designated who's going to present for that? There appears to be silent communication going on, and Will Zachman is stepping forward, as is Wendy, to race to the mics.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid the CAPTCHER working group did not quite reach the same consensus. But we did. We started by outlining some of the groups or types of interests that might capture ICANN to attempt to frame the discussion, and then ranked those as to the fear we had among the group of us that these interests might capture the organization. National interests were ranked number one, followed by commercial interests, the existing board and officers, supporting organizations, and individuals. And basically, we had laid out that the ways in which those groups might be interested in the process, interested in the outcome, and might take it over to achieve their ends. We then tried to lay out some mechanisms of preventing against capture. One suggestion was that there were natural obstacles to capture among the interests and between them, so that national interests might, on their own, look out that no other national interest was gaining too much control. Likewise, corporations would watch out for their fellow corporations lest they get the short end of the stick. And in all of those cases, the openness and transparency of board decisions were critical to allowing these checks to function, that only if they could see what their fellow interests were doing could these organizations check it amongst themselves and provide checks on one another across the structure. Now, as to how these would play out, one thought was a classes of membership within the at-large directors, such that perhaps commercial, national, and individual interests might each have a third of the seats and would hold their separate elections and thus explicitly represent each group of interests. Other participants thought that those interests, that any individual member would be acting in capacities as a national citizen, as a corporate interest, or someone who had ties to corporations and individual capacities, so would act without that explicit classification. Some of the members felt that since individuals were the group among about whose capture we were least concerned in our own ranking, we were not particularly concerned with the idea that individuals or even a group of individuals on their own and not affiliated with these interests would capture the organization. So perhaps a broad membership model of individuals would, and an open membership to them, would prevent against capture by one of the national or commercial interests. A concern from the other end of that spectrum, however, was that the national or commercial interests would effectuate their capture through a group of individuals, and we didn't really get to the bottom of how a corporation might influence its employees, and people with whom it was involved, or a national government might do the same. So again, we came down to transparency and openness and setting up a framework for that. Using the power of the internet for communication and information about what was going on within the board would be one way of checking and holding the board accountable to all of the interests behind it. I think.
Shall we put it to questions from the panel? Ronnie? Esther?
I have a great deal of interest in this question, especially vis-a-vis Russia, where in some sense there is now a free and open press, but it is captured by commercial interests. The truth is published about what is going on, but there are so many lies that are also published that it's impossible to know what's going on. And another question, sort of a related question, if the truth is known, but people are powerless to do anything about it, what are the implications of that? I mean, suppose we had complete openness and we did terrible things, but our bylaws allowed us to do them in full sight.
Well, yes, part of the answer to that is creating a structure where individuals have the power to, or as at-large members have the power to throw out board members who,
right. Can be removed.
Or to change the direction of the organization, essentially, and that giving the power to the individuals will then make them more interested in the organization and will further make them resistant to capture if they feel they have a scope, a stake in the organization and power to make their voice heard and to influence its direction, that they would be less likely to accept a board that functioned against that.
Yes, me?
Yeah, I'm just curious if you explored the possibility of capture away from future members, in the sense that if too much was frozen, emerging countries, for example, might not be able to participate or assert themselves as well. Was this explored, and how do you see it working out?
We did talk about the sense in which an organization itself is conservative, and it'll tend to preserve the structure that it already has. And so to the extent that we are creating an organization with a structure, it will tend on its own to hold that structure, and people who aren't in the creation of that structure don't have such an easy way to get in. I guess at this point the best we can do is to design in as much forward-looking vision in the rules we decide. And we didn't talk about it in this particular session, but at other times the Berkman Group has talked about sunset provisions or various ways of making sure that the board rethinks its underlying assumptions and bylaws to make sure that it can take advantage of future users and give opportunities to them.
Daniel.
Yes. To push a little further on Esther's point, there is great likelihood that if the board is captured, it means that the organization that has voted the board in has been captured too. So transparency will not help for the same reasons that you mentioned, or would not be sufficient at least. So I would really encourage, if it's at all possible, that in the survey that's being done on possible mechanisms, we try to get a kind of benchmark of mechanisms that are being used in other membership organizations, because I feel that this discussion fell short of that, which is understandable because it's not easy. And we need that. We need to figure out if something happens, how can we solve it or prevent it? Maybe we don't want to prevent it, but we want to be able to solve it quickly. Maybe we want heavy mechanisms to prevent it or light mechanisms to prevent it, and that would be very, very useful. Because analysis is one thing, but trying to find solutions is another one.
You mean putting structures into place that we would know when something had failed and so that we would be able to respond to it.
I guess transparency will let us know. So we don't need to have an automatic mechanism that says out of a computer, oh, there's there has been capture. But then how do we solve it? What mechanisms there are for appeal and to rebuild what has to be rebuilt?
Great. Will, is there something you wanted to bracket quickly? You may want to do it from a mic just for the purposes of the streamer.
This is just strictly a matter of adding a little bit to what has already been reported, because there's a couple of things that I think, just for the record of the meeting, we might add. One of them was that on the issue of the five areas of possible sources of takeover, one of the things that we did was we looked at the five, we put them in an initial order of which one we thought was the most significant, and then we each person in the room took 100 points of threat assessment and assigned it to them. And the results, at least for the seven people in the room, were that the one that came out number one, national interest, ended up with an average of 50% of the threat. The commercial interest, 34%. Existing board and officers, 7%. SOs, 7%. And individuals, 2%. So at least for the individuals who were in that room, it was quite clear that national interests and commercial interests were viewed as the most likely sources of a takeover if there was a takeover, and that individuals on their own or collectively was viewed as the least significant threat. I would note that that particular process of assigning the 100 points objective probability and so on could be done as part of a broader survey of a wider constituency and might be of interest. I would also note just a couple other addendums. The issue of the government side of it, it was quite clear that we talked about two different aspects of that. One is governments as national interests per se, but there was a separate concern expressed by at least one or two members concerning the role of national security agencies of one sort or another. There was a sense that the government side of it has two different aspects. One of them is a government wanting to have some sort of role. The other side was a national security agency side. The only one other thing I would mention is one other thing that hasn't gotten, into the record up to this point, is that there was also an express, a concern expressed by at least one individual, and I think with not necessarily consensus, but some support elsewhere, that the at-large members, it was very helpful if the at-large members were people who were well-known and respected within the Internet community generally, and that it was worth thinking at least about some way of perpetuating that in the process if it could be done. Those are just some addenda.
Great, thanks. Esther?
Just in the interest of transparency, is national governments a code word for the United States?
Not entirely. The United States was one that was focused on, but so were large countries that could enlist.
The first country listed was China, actually, and then somebody else mentioned that the United. It was clear that depending on what your predilections were, you would view one or another country as a threat.
Thank you.
From Asia and the Pacific, I have some problem about, citing China as sort of potential player to capture, given the first this provision of the regional representation, that no region cannot really make up too much representation. So are you really serious that these countries or any country will capture in which area in more realistic way?
I mean, this is an interesting
What are the stakes, other than national security perhaps?
This is an interesting question. The membership does not have geographical representation requirements. The board does. But I think one issue is the Chinese government is showing currently a real predilection to control the content on the Internet, to try and, everybody's read what they're up to.
Right. Maybe are the ICANN going to deal with these content issues within given charters? I don't think
no,
so.
No, but suppose we got captured and they tried to. I mean, this is what we're talking about here. This is not a static.
What a wonderful thing with their numbers to capture us. They'd have to open it up to everybody.
I mean.
Yes. I mean, you know, maybe.
If not mistaken, you know, the Chinese government may try to influence within China for their internet policy. Mm-hmm. Are they really trying to control, say, Asia and Pacific policies and things like that? That's your views? It's okay if you have that kind of real opinion, fine, but I'd like to clarify. What are the issues?
But if the Chinese government took over the board, wouldn't that board and that organization die on the spot? I mean, you know, Cisco would take it forever to live. So, what is the threat that we're dealing with? I mean, how far can anyone take it over and survive?
I think, as someone said this morning, we hope that we write our bylaws, we elect our board of directors, and we never ever look at the bylaws again because we operate openly and do the right thing. But it's an extremist when you want to impeach the president, mm-hmm. or when the government of China does try to take over by forming an alliance with the government of Cuba, and maybe the government of Albania, so we now have Europe, Latin America, and Asia Pacific. I mean, idea. You're right.
But alter U.S. next. You move to another network.
And we probably would. But
I think having the numbers should be a good thing for ICANN. I mean, we want to have 100 million, 200 million, billion. That's what we want. So we shouldn't view the numbers as a threat, I think. Right. We should turn it into a positive thing.
Yeah, I agree. And by the same token, now that the majority of the users are aware, and is it fair and balanced or not? Depends on where you position yourself. Mm-hmm. Say, the majority of the users and membership are from North America. Is it captured by? Not necessarily a country. And so you have to make a distinction between the, say, nationality or the members from the region or whatever and a national government as a national interest.
And the language.
Yeah. And so there are different layers of issues, but I have some difficulty understanding what is real national interest to capture ICANN.
Daniel, I'm going to give you the last word on this very interesting debate.
Well, it wasn't intended that way.
Those are the best ones.
First of all, I like national interests better than national governments for the same reasons. But I think for maybe obvious reasons, one category has not been mentioned, and I would suggest it. It's internet professionals. I'm meaning also registries.
Where's Scott Bradner now that we need him?
Exactly. It is interesting to hear the interests that people are clamoring to represent also cited as the primary threats to capture. Yeah. But I guess that's the point. You bring them under the tent so they can't knock it down from outside. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So thank you, Wendy. We have one more breakout group to present. We have eaten nearly all of our breakaway, but I don't think anybody will shed a tear over that. Gene Camp, I see, is coming forward to present from Group 3.
We have a series of recommendations and three questions. We looked at a range of models for nomination. We would advocate that any member can self-nominate, but self-selection requires certain action. First of all, it requires a petition and this and information. The information provided first must be the identity of the candidate. Second, the office for which the candidate is running. Third, a bio of not more than 250 words and a statement of not more than 250 words. So you know when we're exact, we're exact. And we say the citizen must have internet access. Oh, sorry.
I was just wondering if it specified what language the statements had to be in.
Yes, we actually didn't specify that, but that's later. You must have internet access required and the time commitment to be able to serve. We had one query, which is, when you provide claims, what about auditing claims? How will the claims be audited? One of the claims must be citizenship, where citizenship is defined by the nation in which you are claiming citizenship at the time of the election, so you don't have problems with self-created citizenship, shall we say.
Okay, so one of the questions on which there was not consent is, what about auditing claims, and what about rejecting candidates when claims are found to be false? Second, another question we had was, what about age as an identifier? Now, that might seem obvious, but then we came to the conclusion that one possibility is that you have to provide a binary identifier. Are you of age of legal consent in the region where you are running? The idea there being, no one will know what the age of legal consent is in every jurisdiction. So that if you just identify your age and say, hey, I'm 18, we would assume that is the age of consent, where in fact what you might be voting for is someone's parent or someone's legal guardian that was then not actually identified. So either a binary or an age. Another question is that we choose to bring to the back to the committee, is the duty adequate requirement, where we said you must have internet access and a willingness for duty, or should it be more defined? Should the person be required to say, I will commit this many hours? We did have consent that email access and an ability to take part in the discussion were necessary. We very clearly don't want an ability to take part in the discussion to mean you have to speak English. But it does mean that you need to be able to provide your own translation services, whether these provided electronically or through human. We would like to recommend a standing or otherwise committee to deal with nomination / membership / election or certification, which takes care of the mechanics and administration necessary to support the election, deals with objective criteria, including fraud, questions of quorum, and election mechanics. When identifying oneself as a candidate, the person must provide a disclosure that illustrates affiliations, any possible conflicts of interest, as well as a financial disclosure. And a candidate cannot be part of the aforementioned election / nomination / certification committee. So I'm going to let the typist keep up with me there. We have two other recommendations. This is a minor and a major, with our minor recommendation being membership fraud is voter fraud. We propose in mechanisms to prevent voter fraud, or should be investigated and selected. We did consider the Internet Society model, and we said for the purposes of voting for the board, that fees should be to cover cost of authentication and membership and not as a poll tax kind of high-level fees. Our major recommendation upon trying to construct a way to nominate directors was that the current bylaws on geographical representation limit both individual voter autonomy and the simple feasibility of elections. That we are not opposed to diversity. We validate geographic diversity, but it needs to be revisited for reasons of feasibility. And when we say individual voter autonomy, we don't mean a person's right to vote for people that are only like them and have them elected. The idea being that the supporting organizations will vote first, and then they can decide by virtue of their slate of candidates who the membership at large can vote for. So that was our concern there, and we strongly recommend revisiting and rephrasing it in a way that is more feasible mechanically.
Thoughts from the panel? Daniel?
Can you be more specific on why it is infeasible? Because, it's a statement, and it might be an important one, so we need to understand what's the problem.
I would like to yield the floor to Scott Brandner at this moment.
This is also addressed in your packet, and Tom Bentun Nebham has written a paper on some of these issues.
They're in there somewhere. There are a number of different pieces, but a very simple example is, let's say an SO selects somebody for whatever reason and follows their procedures to select somebody which does not meet the geographical distribution requirements of the board itself. The bylaws have two different places they refer to this. One is where it says that the board will elect the candidate as nominated by the SO, and another one, which is where they're talking about the diversity. These are mutually contradictory. It can't do both. But the overall function is, the overall problem is that if the SOs choose first, it reduces the flexibility of the at-large members to be able to select the candidates they want to. If the at-large selects first, then it reduces the flexibility of the SOs to do it. The SOs, three different SOs, have to cooperate together somehow to figure out which geographic candidates they can support individually. This reduces their own flexibility, but it also makes the actual process very difficult. Let's say two different SOs hold a selection process at the same time, and they came up with their selections, but together the selections violate the geographic diversity. Which SO has to go back and revisit its candidate to correct that diversity problem? There's a great deal of problems like that which wind up with a deadlock. I wind up with fundamentally something that I don't believe can actually be executed.
Siegfried, you had a reaction?
Was that clear enough?
Yes, it was. The question was basically, are you referring to contradictions in the words or to the objective itself?
No.
Because obviously we have to be very conscious of the fact that the objective and that the level of diversity is the result of long and arduous international negotiation. The mechanism has to be worked on, but the result probably is not very negotiable.
Yeah, Gene was very, very, very specific to say this subcommittee did not object to the objective, that the specific way to implement it was something that actually it does not look like it actually can work.
Other comments from the panel? Esther?
Well, I don't, this is a really important issue, and I don't know how we're going to deal with it, so I'm going to go on to something else, which is simply, was there any discussion of how the voting should work, cumulative voting for slates, parties? I mean, what?
We did look at options for slates, but it was our understanding in the committee that that's part of the membership decision. And by suggesting that you form a standing or otherwise committee, we feel that we fulfill that requirement. Yes, a lot of people use slates. You can also have this thing where you vote for three of these and one of these and two of those, and that there was quite a range of options.
Yes, me.
Yeah, on the translation services, I think that you make a sort of a requirement. How do you see that as constraining those candidates, in the sense that now the onus is upon them to provide the translation service? How big a cost or difficulty do you perceive that? And therefore, how would it impact candidates coming from some regions?
The reason we sought to include a requirement that a candidate be willing to take part, that was part of the requirement that a candidate be willing to take part and represent their organization, that is in with the time requirement. The time requirement will also knock out many people, as will the internet access requirement. But the one overall goal was to ensure that whoever is elected can very effectively serve their constituents.
Yeah, if I could add something, I think Gene answered correctly in terms of the discussion. We probably should, there was an assertion made that translation was very expensive, as I recall, and we should probably try to understand how expensive that is and upon whom that burden should fall financially. But we ought to get an idea. I don't know what expensive means.
The European Commission does. It's very expensive, but at the same time, there are millions and millions of people who are capable of doing it, who might want to do it as volunteers for their language communities. And in fact, we had a Latin American lunch, and I suggested that if they wanted to produce a partial or full translation of everything on the website into Spanish and possibly Portuguese, we would welcome it, and it certainly would apply to any other language. That's not the same as ICANN undertaking to do it itself.
Right.
But it's a point worth noting.
I'm just suggesting we ought to take translation as a line item and kind of decide what do we mean, how will we deal with it?
And which languages do we leave out?
Yeah, and how expensive is it?
We haven't really discussed them since it's more or less of the procedure for the voting or selection of the board members. But there was some provisional clause in the IANA's version 4, whatever, to provide some foreign language translations of the major document of IANA, which is not there in the ICANN's final bylaws. That's I just found that should be addressed later.
Great, thank you, Gene. At this point, we have the next panel ready to start. I'd like to suggest that we take a break of no more than 90 seconds, which gives a chance for evacuation of this panel and the entry of the new one. Yes? Well, there'll be discussion in the next panel. I just want to get the next group up. You wondering if you're on it? I think you are.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Who's on the next panel? Oh, in fact, yeah.
These things are being picked up. It shows a really good. I'd love to see the effect. What's the question? Can you straw proposals that you'd have to put together? Or just, they're not meant to be together?
Jonathan, could I just congratulate you on a great job today?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, are you going to be around for the reception too?
Yeah.
Okay. But if you want to ask this question publicly, let me figure that out. I want to do it.
And by the way, when I just described to you,
that proves that that's just a theoretical limit. Which only shows I'm working for that part.
Look at the front, you'll see the panelists.
Thank you.
Here's a list of some questions. That's a live mic.
Thank you.
It's a very rare occurrence.
A couple hundred years it happens.
Every once in a totally blue moon.
You're on this panel, number two. Is tomorrow? So Jonathan said that we would stop for 90 seconds, and you've just seen 90 seconds of academic time pass. I'm Larry Lessig. I'm the Berkman Professor at Harvard Law School and affiliate of the Berkman Center. And Jonathan and the Berkman Center have asked me to chair this final panel, which is an opportunity for us to step back from the process and be a little bit more reflective about some of the issues that have been raised, both from the perspective of people inside the process and also people, quite frankly, outside the process. I'd like to begin by asking Elaine, actually, if she can give us her reactions from the perspective of a political scientist to what we've seen so far in the discussion about the structuring of this ICANN membership organization.
Thank you, Larry. Let me begin by saying that I came here fairly uninitiated this morning at the assistance of the dean, who said we ought to be involved in this, and listened with great interest and great admiration, because I think you're trying to do something here that is A, very difficult, and B, fairly unprecedented. And the unprecedented nature of this, I think I want to explain a little bit. And frankly, I think if we begin with the distinctions between the two organizational forms that are have been batted around today, it might help us with these governance questions. You've really talked almost intermittently all day long about two very different kinds of organizations. The first panel up here was composed of people who belong to what political scientists call interest groups. Interest groups are very important parts of our democracy. They are protected by the First Amendment and by the right of free association. But interest groups are distinctive in that they are voluntary organizations. People of like mind band together to do what? To influence some entity, usually the government. In fact, there's a nice, clean distinction between interest groups and government. Common cause is an interest group. Interest groups typically in the American democracy have easy entrance and easy exit, and they have very little coercive authority. In other words, you don't have to be a member of the ABA, which is a fairly powerful interest group, to be licensed to practice law in a state. Even though the ABA is a quite important group, has something to do with judges, etc., nevertheless, they are not in the Constitution. The Senate of the United States does not have to consider the ABA in confirming a judge. They're important. Many interest groups become very important. As we know, for better or for worse, many interest groups even are deeply involved in the writing of legislation. Nevertheless, interest groups, which is what you heard from this morning and which many of the models are, interest groups are not governmental entities. They exist to influence governmental entities. Now, the second kind of group that we've also talked about today are regulatory agencies of the government. Regulatory agencies are very distinct in their form. First of all, we pay a lot of attention in the United States and in many democracies to who runs regulatory agencies. The head of the Food and Drug Administration is required to submit a financial statement before his or her nomination. Not only is he or she required to submit that statement is double-checked by law enforcement agencies, notably the FBI and the IRS. There are severe penalties for lying on that financial statement. You can go to jail. You can get in serious trouble. It's not just a matter of being thrown out of the organization. You can be in trouble. Secondly, regulators, people who hold regulatory authority, are in fact subject to Senate confirmation. So even if their background, their interests, their point of view are held up and discussed and batted around and batted back and forth by people who are legitimately elected by the voters. I make a big deal about this because, in fact, regulatory agencies exercise the power of the state. They have enforcement capacity. They have the capacity to shut down your factory, to keep your product from going to market. They have real economic power. They exert real economic power. And because of that, we in the democracy of the United States and other democracies, in fact, require regulators to go through lots and lots of hoops. As a matter of fact, it's full employment for lawyers. Okay, we require regulators to do process, 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 process. Why? Because, in fact, they have power. They exert real economic power. Now, today we've discussed sometimes the ICANN as an interest group, and sometimes we've discussed the ICANN as a regulatory agency. When we've gotten to the question of international membership in the ICANN, it's gotten even more confused. The way we establish legitimacy and accountability in international governance is, frankly, through treaties and through treaty organizations. Treaties are entered into by sovereign governments who have, in fact, enforcement capacity. We're not talking anywhere here today about a meaningful enforcement capacity. And even if ICANN was to establish an enforcement capacity, the question is, where does it get its legitimacy from? I think there are severe analytical problems because we are here confronted with an entity that in fact is neither one thing nor another. It's not really an interest group like Ahern's group of professionals, you know. I mean, if you're an internet professional and you like what your group's doing, you join and pay your dues and become active. If you don't like it, you break off into another group. And actually, some people did that. That's an interest group. There's freedom in and out, and there's really no coercive authority. You don't need to go get permission from Ahern to go get a job in a computer company. I'm sure you'd like to do that, but you don't really need to do that. You're working on it. That's an interest group. That is one kind of entity. A regulatory entity that exerts any kind of meaningful economic power, in fact, is almost always a governmental entity, and it is subject to all the things that we put in the way to make sure that people are impartial and that there's lots of process and that there's lots of transparency and there's lots of due process. So I think one of the reasons, frankly, that it is so difficult to come up to the answers for these questions is that we do not really know what kind of body we're dealing with. Now, let me make, in closing, you have two, I think, options before you. One is to go ahead and try to create essentially a self-governing entity. The problem I see before you is that you are no longer dealing with a medium that is limited to a fairly small group of people. This exponential growth of this medium, even just between 1997 when the paper was published and now, is such that there are looming on the horizon issues that are public interest issues that have to do with the internet. And once there become public issues, citizen issues, if you will, then interest groups are notoriously bad at dealing with them in any definitive way, even though interest groups are good at representing one group of citizens' interests versus another's. But there is no end point. So I think that has to be dealt with. Secondly, there is the question of when and where does the government come into this arena? And certainly one of the issues that it seems that a group like this ought to grapple with is what are the things that it is realistic to expect us to do in a self-governing mode, and what are the things that eventually you will in fact need governmental interference, and how should that be designed? In what way should that be designed? Let me close by saying that there is a profound difference between government regulation and a regulatory entity and an interest group or a trade association or an industry association, and that until a decision is made about what this group is going to be, I don't believe it will be possible for you to answer any of the questions that you've looked at today.
Well, let me follow that up with a question for you then. So you've given us a map, and the map says that there are two entities out there. And we come to this entity and we discover, you know, it doesn't look a lot like either of these two entities. Now, one response is to change the map, and the other response is to change the entity. Knock down a building if it doesn't conform to what the map is, or redraw the map. Mm-hmm. Which should we be doing in a context like this? Because the fact is, this entity can have a kind of power that I'm not sure is really explained by your model. Your model typically talks about governments enforcing, and they enforce using police. But this entity could have an extraordinary amount of power just by recognizing or not recognizing other organizations, or recognizing or not recognizing certain protocols. And then it gets its power because this is an internet organization and protocols are the power. So what should we do in response to this complication, the fact that your map doesn't explain this entity?
I think that as long as there is consensus, right, as long as you can establish consensus, which is entirely possible, then this works fine in this kind of hybrid organization. The problem comes when you turn down someone, when you don't recognize a protocol, and they, what do? They sue you, right? They take you to court. They sue you in the law of whatever state the person was who made that decision or pushed that button or whatever. And I think you then have the second generation of this. See, all of these things work. You don't have to make this clear-cut distinction as long as there's a general consensus, there's like-mindedness in the community. The problem, of course, comes when there's conflict in the community. The problem comes when suddenly you discover one day that all that 15 out of your 18 people are on Bill Gates' payroll. Yeah. Okay, and people can't get in. Then what do you do?
Right.
You see,
so
then
let's take
you
your hypothetical example, not recognizing a certain protocol. So imagine I'm leading to you, Scott, so I hope by the time I finish my question you'll be at the mic. Let's say that ICANN doesn't recognize a certain protocol of the recommended by the IETF. Now, lawsuits, that sounds like an odd thing to be talking about here. What happens, Scott?
Well, it's odd in two ways. One is that while we have a surfeit of amateur lawyers in the IETF, we don't have very many real ones. So that wouldn't be a terribly useful thing to do. The other thing is that ICANN doesn't have the power to recognize or not recognize a protocol under its bylaws or under its charge. It has the power to coordinate the assignment of protocol numbers. The court doesn't actually have the power to assign numbers. It doesn't have the power to recognize or not recognize a protocol. So I think that the question is valid, but not relative to protocols. Let's say, let's put it to a different thing, which is let's say the ICANN refuses to recognize the delegation of a top-level domain to .tv,
okay,
which makes it a very concrete thing that's within ICANN's power structure.
Okay, let's take this as an example. People on the panel want to respond to this. Daniel, do you? Let's take this as an example. How should we think about this type of conflict? Scott's given us a hypothetical, the refusal to recognize .tv domain.
About the technical part, but there are some communities which do not need the government to govern. They have other mechanisms. Ostracism, for example, is one of them, and I'm not sure, but I suspect that not being disconnected from the internet may be the death knell to some groups that do not agree with the mainstream. After all, the internet is built on a consensus but not on a unanimity. So if too many people don't agree, the board will have to kind of bend or otherwise. This is number one. But in this particular case, they usually find a solution outside the courts, and I'm not sure that the courts will intervene. One last thing. In the works is also a court as part of the internet that will look at authority and determine the authority of the board. It will be kind of judicial-like, and that may be the alternative to government.
Let me ask you this. Who would appoint that court?
Oh, we are at the beginning, and that question is always asked. It was asked about the initial board. And we were tremendously lucky in getting, I think, a tremendously group together. How that alchemy came about, don't ask me. But the internet is lucky in so many ways. This is one of them. I really truly believe that. So I think, again, there will be a surge of consensus. For example, it is an assumption that these people, this kind of judge-like group, say will be populated by retired judges, either of the Supreme Court or of higher courts, both in the United States and abroad. They may be people who would be highly regarded.
Jay, did you want to add something here?
The question that you asked, you posed about the .TV, is an example of why this organization needs to use a consent of the governed model of enforcement. The authority is given to you by the consensus of the community. The internet is actually thousands and thousands of individual private networks that agree to interconnect. And if anybody tries to take a heavy hand and say, this is how we will do it, you would have to enforce that in thousands or hundreds of countries throughout the world. So your authority comes up from the individual networks and the people who are on the net.
Daniel.
Yeah. Not to deal specifically with the example, but with any kind of conflictual example. By the way, I'm happy it's not a Frenchman who said what you just said. One of them did in Geneva almost a year ago, and they said, oh, the Frenchmen are at it again. They'll never understand those new animals. And then, oh, girl, an American is saying it. Okay, so that proves that we're indeed in a complex area and that it may fail. We do not know yet if it is going to succeed. What we can really feel is that, first of all, we have to be very careful, at least at the beginning, but I think forever, to strictly stick to the limited functions ICANN has been given. If ICANN tries or lets itself move towards becoming the internet government, then obviously governments will say, no, we are the governments, sorry. And they will totally disenfranchise ICANN. Second of all, we should really focus on how we make decisions more than on how we vote. How we build policies and how the decision goes from down to up and back down, etc. And how we try to reach consensus on that in a fairly efficient way. Because again, otherwise, if time and again there are votes that let some people, most of all some nationalities, unhappy, then governments will come back. And we must know that eventually, if they want to take their power back, they can any day. So if they decide they'll do it, they will do it.
Yeah, I agree with Daniel as to the, we should put more emphasis or focus on the how to reach the consensus rather than how to vote or how to restrict the candidates and things like that. I have many hats. On one hat, I work for APIA. It's a trade association of internet service providers and vendors in Asia and the Pacific, so some region of labor. And on the other hand, I'm one of the users of the net. As a trade association, we should buy more common sense approach, ordinary type of, you know, decision making and things like that. But if you look at how the people are using the net and at the netizens case or how the IETF made the decisions and with rough consensus and seemingly endless discussion on the mailing list, similar to what we have, I think we have to really create much more sort of creative solution or that kind of fora we experienced with ISWP or yesterday or today. And so if we end up with some very conventional sort of decision-making process that seems to be legitimate for the previous paradigm of the governments, I don't think that would work for the problems or challenges we are facing.
Andy, did you have something on this?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's related. It's related to capture, and it's related to the question of lack of consensus. Practically speaking, I think we could design a wonderful membership structure. I'm glad I was here to try to help do that. But in a few months, things will settle down. The major decisions we made, a lot of people won't like it, but they'll sort of go back to their day jobs. And then we'll have one or two people sort of like UN observers in Kosovo watching what ICANN does. Now, these people don't like what's going on. How can they rouse the rest of the membership? Are they going to get their email addresses and spam them with a manifesto? Will they have a meeting where they can present their views, and will the members pay any attention when they do? Same question goes for forming an alternative slate of candidates. So we really should be thinking about the possibility of having faction fights in ICANN. Not a very pleasant idea, but something that may save it in the long run.
I'm sorry, just clarify that, faction fights?
Yeah, that is, if you have just a couple people who are still active, everybody who is interested in ICANN is just a lawyer representing a particular trademark holder or something, except for one or two people who represent this sort of vague idea of public interest. Let's say these people think there's something rotten going on and they want to rouse the membership. Now it's time to bring the membership back in, have everybody talk the way we've been talking over the past couple years. So they have to have a way of doing this, and if things are too close, then capture has occurred and they can't really present their alternative.
Rhonda, did you have
yes.
something?
Yeah, a couple of things. Elaine, I thought it was very helpful you're spelling out the two different models, but I have a slightly different model instead of the regulatory. I thought it's the public utility, because when there's at stake something that people need, and that if somebody grabs hold of it, they can charge me anything, and you've got to deal with it. I'm stuck. Then governments have found they have to deal with that, and that here the central points of functions of the internet are at stake. And so there's going to be a number of people fighting for the power in the power vacuum to grab them. And that's why you have government and regulation. And that's why also to have governments that are there behind the scenes, not out front, we have no way to get to them, but in fact they're functioning, but not in a way that we can pin them down. And so we're lost, that the people who built the internet, the people who built it are a number of pioneers, but also a lot of tax money is going in around the world to build this. It's a very precious resource. A lot of people are dependent. So I think what's been raised in the past is the concept of an international public utility. That involves government in some way. There's no model that I know of for that. But I thought some of the problem is by government saying we're not going to be there, then we can't see what they're doing, and they are doing things behind the scenes very clearly, and we can't affect what they're doing. Instead, we're faced with whoever these people are and whatever they're doing and what's the real thing going on. So I think we're in a very dangerous situation, because the internet, it's not a matter of lawsuits. It's a matter of the day-to-day need of many people around the world, and the internet is functions because it's been protected. The protection's being taken away, and it's being put exactly what it needed to be protected against. So we have a real problem. How we deal with it, I think, one, it requires that the real issues get out on the table, that government be out there as what's needed from them, what are they doing, why, and we begin to look at that. And then two, that there be some, we stop the phony process. We understand there are a lot of power plays going on, that there are a lot of interests who want to get in there and control it. And therefore, it's not a matter of waking up some people once in a while, that it's not, I can't fight against, as you say, if Microsoft is taking it over, or if MCI is taking it over, or if the U.S. government is doing something that they shouldn't be doing. I can't fight it. And that's why we need it out open on the table, but we need something very different happening than what's happening here. So I guess I'm raising, how do we get onto a ground where we're beginning to look at what's really going on, so we can begin to try to figure out what is going to solve them? There are real problems. How do we solve them?
Okay. Jay?
Speaking to what Elaine said, and maybe what Rhonda said, I think that Elaine's picture is too simple, that is ICANN trying to be a regulatory, is it trying to be an interest? I think to me the problem is that ICANN has been pushed to try to become something it can't become. That is, it's been pushed to say it has to be a private entity by the white paper process, and it's trying to conform to a process that doesn't say, what if we can't conform to the process? And so it leaves itself in a trap of trying to be something that the source of that is outside of ICANN itself. And the problem there is that if, in fact, ICANN is trying to do something significant, It has to examine the premises on which it was put forward to decide whether or not those premises represent a roadblock to its doing something significant. And so I think the problem is not the two models so much as what's behind what brought ICANN to this stage and what changes does the ICANN process have to produce an effective or a possibly useful activity that will add to the development and spread of the Internet, and we'll respect that.
Gene, then Daniel.
Okay, I want to say, you know, it might turn out that you can't do this, and it might turn out that this fails as soon as, and I think TV was actually a great example, because, what country is that, I'm sorry? Okay, so, you know, suppose the independent, totally radical Republic of Tuvalu takes over and decides that they're going to do nothing but commit fraud and send out really bad router information, and then the board has to act, and then the board chooses to act against that domain, and all of a sudden all the television stations that thought this was a great idea suddenly object. You know, we will have tests, but to say that we will have tests is to say that we'll fail. And it's not like the court hasn't already gotten involved, and the fact that the court got involved and reversed some of NSI's decision didn't mean that NSI ceased to function, and whether in that case that was a good or bad thing, I shall not say. But it is a new thing. This is a new thing, and it's worth trying, and it's worth doing, and I don't think it's necessary that it will fail, because in fact, if someone just gets really mad and the ICANN is really the consent of the government, if you say, well, we're going to, you know, it turns out that Bill Gates takes over the board and that the government of France says we're not going to buy any Microsoft, and he decides to cut off that domain, well, no one will listen to him, and people will keep updating their routers. And because of the consent of the government, because it's in a constrained environment, and because they're, you know, the ICANN is not going to try to, specifically because they're not going to try to send out police, but have only economic power and not physical power, that I think that this is a worthy and possibly will be a successful experiment.
But let me just ask a question that you can either respond to, or maybe this will set something of the further responses. There's this rhetoric out there about bottom-up democracy or bottom-up governance, and that's very much at the core of the history of the Internet's self-governance. But the fact is, when people use the phrase consent of the governed, they're using it to justify their top-down regulation. They're using it to say, you see, we have the consent of the governed, and now we can say, you must do this. Now, is it your view when you say, for example, you use the example of some industrialist, I can't remember who says we're no longer going to recognize this particular country because of blah, blah, blah. Is the problem with that example that it's a top-down regulation, or is the problem with that example the content of the regulation? So is it that whenever we have a top-down requirements, there will be resistance in this culture, or is it just that some of these top-down requirements or decisions by a coordinating body such as ICANN could yield problems in the actual implementation because the content is bad? Daniel, you want to pick up on that, or?
I wasn't prepared to answer that.
That's the way I make my money.
Thank you. Yes. Me too. So I'd probably make it. There are two very different questions, actually, and one of the elements of complexity with ICANN is that it makes policy and enforces it too, and that makes it a little problematic. What I feel, to answer the globally in the discussion, and then people can take a more direct crack at your question, is that we are creating something new. Maybe it'll fail, but we are here at least to find out ways of making it work, And then maybe within 2 years we'll say, we didn't. Okay, let's try. And we have some positive examples in several fields, not in the field of content, which is the new problem that we're facing, or of trademarks, but in complex technical fields where there are very big interests at stake, something bottom-up-ish has happened and worked and been enforced through some sort of peer pressure. So it has worked. Now, I would like also to suggest that people think about what ICANN might be in 3 years' time. We have one or two very complex policy issues now. One of them will probably be solved by technical means. It's the scarcity of addresses. If we have no scarcity of addresses, we have one political problem less.
Okay, there's no scarcity of addresses.
Okay.
There's 4.3 billion and there's 6 billion people in the world. For the moment, there's no scarcity.
Okay, so we don't have that problem yet now, so we don't have any political problem with addresses. It's even better. Then there's another problem, which is TLDs. Okay, at some point, there will be rules. There will be a row, and then there will be a rules. And then ICANN will become a very boring administrative organization, and what its members and supervisors may want to do is keep it that way and say, don't go into other regulatory areas just because you're bored. Okay? And then the whole membership issue is going to change very much, because the motivation for being active members is going to change drastically. So we should think our system for both periods, and maybe even think a system for devising policy which is fairly different from the system for running day-to-day ICANN activities and supervising them.
At this mic over here.
Thank you. I want to say two things. The first is directed to the HOBANs. Constant bringing up of an issue which I consider a non-issue, and that's the transfer of government purview of property to the private sector. There's a long history of that in most countries. I've lived in a number of countries and have experienced the nationalization of private interests and the privatization of national interests. I don't remember any time having seen a referendum put up to the public of any country when a government decided to transfer assets from the public sector to the private sector. You may disagree with that morally, but that's the history of human society. The railroads in this country were a public utility, and a decision was made on a governmental level because they were being run inefficiently. They were transferred to the private sector, and the public was not given the opportunity to vote on whether that transfer was going to be made. It was an administrative decision, and it was simply made because that was in the good of the railroads as far as the government was concerned. You may disagree with that, but the government has the right to do that. They've done it with many things. I've looked at the same thing going on in South America with the telephones, which were national utilities in Argentina, and they were not being run correctly, and the government sold them to the private sector, and they didn't ask anybody's permission to do it.
Excuse me, that's not true. Because in all of those instances, particularly in the United States, the people making those decisions were elected by citizens of the United States. So they were exercising their constitutional representative authority. The problem you have here is the consent of the governed problem.
Excuse me.
It's not universal.
I'll address that. That was the second part that I was going to address, which I was going to address to you. But these two people continually bring up, they're saying all the time that the government cannot transfer property to the private sector without putting it up to the public via a referendum. They don't say that, but that's what they're suggesting. I say that that hasn't been done in the past. Now the second part, which is, I'll direct to you. I don't know how, if you know the history of this process, but the National Science Foundation had governmental purview over the
no,
dot. file, the root.
Sure.
It transferred that authority to the Department of Commerce, which now has congressional oversight. The Department of Commerce has decided to transfer that property to the private sector. Now, I do not see anything illegal about that process. I was at a hearing a number of months ago, a joint science basic science technology hearing at the House of Representatives, in which Chip Pickering directed that question to Becky Burr, the representative of the Department of Commerce. Do you have legal authority to transfer this property to the private sector? And she said, yes, we do, and we can prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she did. Excuse me, you're interrupting me. If you don't want to respect Robert, nobody interrupts you when you talk. Oof. If you won't respect Robert Wu's orders, then leave. So I just wanted to remind everybody that there is a process here which we all consider legal, or we probably wouldn't be coming here. I wouldn't be intervening in this process if I didn't consider that it was being conducted in a normal and legal way. Okay? And one last thing, which just is to answer the first thing that you brought up, this confusion between regulation, regulatory agencies, and self-interest groups. The white paper, or the Department of Commerce, has simply told the internet interest groups to get together and self-regulate. Now, that seems to me a perfectly reasonable request. Do we need to belabor the issue of what the difference between regulatory agencies and interest groups is once we've been just simply told, all right, all you special interest groups, please get together and self-regulate? That seems clear enough to me. I don't see that there's any real problem with that.
I didn't get to finish my question. My question was, what I said was the problem was more complex than the two regulatory and interest model. The essence of my question is there's still government activity that put this on the table, not only the U.S. government, the U.S. government in conjunction with other governments. So I wonder if anybody can shed light on that activity. What is it that's put this on the table that requires this group to accept the mandate from the white paper that it has to end up being only a private entity? I don't understand why that restriction is carried on. And that's was the question I tried to
ask. Esther, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, very briefly. We're not actually a private entity as far as I see it. We're a public entity. It's just not the U.S. public. In an answer to Elaine's thing, all the confusion and struggle and everything that you're seeing here is an attempt not to get the consent of the governed, but to get something that is the creation of the governed. And we're trying to limit what it is we're governing because we have no legitimacy at this point. That's part of the issue here. And finally, to go back to the Tuvalu issue, there's a number of ways to deal with spam. If a government decides that a certain person should not be heard, and they shut that person up, it's censorship. If I decide not to listen to that person and filter that person individually, that's my own personal decision, and I can do it. What we're talking about with Tuvalu is, yes, well, it's a collective decision to filter. In this case, it would be a domain. And a collective decision is what a government does. These are all points. The question is how you fit them all together, what they mean. Is the decision really collective? Is this really the creation of the governed, or is it some private entity deciding to filter somebody? What I can is right now, or sorry, what the thing that we are taking over was a system that was basically, rather than private filtering, it was private acceptance. Everybody went to these root servers because that was where you could find everybody else. That was, if you like, not just consent of the governed, but acknowledgement and recognition of the governed that this was the place to go to get to the other people there. And what we're trying to do is to build something that takes
that beginning, which is consensus recognition, rather than a revolution on the one hand or the divine right of kings, and to prolong it and make it more formal within a body that did not formally need rules or lawyers or transparency or openness because everybody involved with it agreed to it. Now we're trying to get more explicit agreement.
Scott?
Yeah, I want to put together what Jay and Esther said to sort of meld it together a little bit. Jay mentioned the consent of the governed. It's actually a little bit more than that. That the mechanism by which ICANN is designed to make policy is a bottoms-up process where different groups from within the constituencies, this is the primary method, different groups within the address constituency, a names constituency, or whatever, can propose through their own mechanisms, their own procedures to come to their own consensus, can propose policies, procedures, or whatever. This then gets vetted through the ICANN process and using a wider constituency. And the wider constituent consists of the other SOs, the ICANN at-large board, public comment, and the like. This winds up with, in the normal circumstance, that the ICANN board is to accept or reject a policy developed from below. This is not that the ICANN board comes along and says, we don't like .tv, and therefore it shall not exist. Make it not so. The ICANN board doesn't have that process the way as in the default case. Now, there are a couple of other ways that that policy can be developed. ICANN board can decide that there needs to be policy in some area and ask an SO to investigate that. And most of the time, in theory, the SO is going to go off and think about it. But the SO could say, we don't agree that there shouldn't be policy in this area. Now, remember, the SOs are very much bottoms-up organizations. The final way is that somebody could throw an idea over the transom, and then the ICANN board refers that to the individual SOs and discusses it within the board after that process. But the point here is that the policy is one that has to be approved by the ones that are going to be implementing it, not just everybody else. A policy that was developed by the ICANN board and said, okay, the address people can no longer assign addresses to Libya. Unless the address folks agree to that, agree in advance that this is something that they're willing to do, the ICANN board doesn't have any way to enforce that, nor structurally does it have a way to even state that.
But let me ask you something, Scott. The board has the power to recognize supporting organizations and has the power to recognize the bylaws of supporting organizations. If a supporting organization misbehaves from the perspective of the board, which from the perspective of the board might mean doesn't do what we want it to do, then at least in the structure that I saw, the board has the power to say, you're no longer the supporting organization here. Doesn't that, in a sense, create this possibility, at least, of power being exercised in a way that's not precisely the bottom-up structure you've described?
I don't think so, because let's look at that example. Let's say the board decides that the address supporting organization is being a naughty kid and they should want to disband them. Well, the address supporting organization is made up of the people that hand out addresses. If the board wants to be involved in handing out addresses, it has to deal with the folks that are handing out addresses. If they are not willing to get together and form another address supporting organization, or if the board recognizes an address supporting organization doesn't happen to have any address allocators in it, it has little effect. So
if the names organization starts recognizing Palestine and the board gets a lot of pressure from government saying this is not going to happen, they don't have the same kind of power that the address organization, the address SO has, right?
So it depends on the level. And the same thing in the address organization. If two out of the three address people say, we agree with the board and we'll go off and form another organization which is subservient and bows down and kisses feet,
right,
then that will happen. I doubt in the name support environment the same thing could happen. If the majority of the TLD operators in one way or another, registries or registrars, agree that this is not the right way, we need a different way, then they can form another organization. But I think it would be very unproductive for the board to try and decertify an organization which is made up of the very people that need to be there in order to implement the policy.
Yeah, unproductive and stupid, but those typically are not constraints on governing organizations.
It certainly is not a constraint on government. But.
Jay, did you want to?
Sure. First, I'd like to say I knew if we kept at this for a couple years, Scott Bradner and I would be arguing the same point of view. People would have never believed that. Going back to this concept of consent of the governed and the role of ICANN, I see it in lines with what Esther said, as we're formalizing an informal process at the same time that we're bringing in a lot of new stakeholders and have different needs and different background and history than the way that the Internet initially started, which was basically a technical research community. As we formalize that, what we're actually building is a system of contracts so that we understand what our rights and what our obligations are. And that's going to transcend domain names and IP addresses. And so I wanted to put that on the record because whenever I hear somebody say that this is only about some technical functions, it makes my hair stand on end because I know that what we're really establishing in here is how those relationships are going to work. And it's conceivable that in order to even log on to the Internet, you're going to agree, I will not spam. I mean, that's one good example. And the reason that this is required is to do it otherwise means you're going to go to 240 different countries around the world and try and pass some legislation. And this is simply a much quicker and easier way to do that. And it also makes a lot more sense from a point of view of, let's build a cohesive Internet worldwide that everybody can agree to live with.
Is there a response to that here? Rhonda, did you have something?
Yeah. First of all, I was at the hearing that Michael referred to, and he did misrepresent it because Chip Pickering did ask. Well, it wasn't Chip Pickering actually. It was the representative from Virginia asked what was the authority, and he asked Becky Burr, and all Becky Burr had to say was that their lawyers tell them they don't need any or they already have it. There was nothing that she gave, and that. What was interesting in the memorandum of understanding, there's a section that says authority, and it has nothing to do with the authority to be doing any of this. It only has something to do with the authority of the Commerce Department to be entering into agreements. And so it's not the issue, it didn't take the important question. And the reason it's an important question by what authority is because the, it's not the Haubans that have raised the issue of what's going on with all of this. It's the Office of Inspector General overseeing the NSF undertaking a very small piece of this, which had to do with the domain names, and I thought they also looked at the IP addresses. And they basically said that the U.S. government does not have the authority to transfer policy to some private entity, and that they said that's a constant. That's something they're not allowed to do. And they also said that the U.S. government has the obligation to be dealing with the great amount of taxpayer money that was spent to create the U.S. part of the Internet. And that, so it's not that this is done all the time. I guess I've talked to somebody who doesn't know the Internet. She said, this is the biggest giveaway ever. You know, what is this about? And it sets the basis for giveaways of public property to some private entities all over the world. So it's a very disastrous situation. And so to say it's been done before, but it's also been learned that this is disastrous and that it's it leads to the worst corruption, to the vying and the political fighting of the power hungry who are there to grab for themselves. And so in the paper I have, I allude to just a little bit of that history, and that's where the concept of a public utility came from, out of the long history. So to say there's no history, there's no government, we're starting from scratch, there's no Internet, we're creating something totally new, we're going to experiment on this grandest scale of ever, of taking over the Internet. So who's doing this? Who's interested in this? And why, you know, why is this happening? I think that's a very serious question to be raised. There is a way to try to do something on a small scale if you have some legitimacy. You try it, you have a clear sense. That is some of the way that the Internet was developed. It wasn't developed by taking massive amounts of public resources and throwing them out to some private entities and say, go fight over it, which is what this is really doing. So this flies in the face of history, of government, and then the other piece of that is the public interest. There is a public interest. I realize that getting rid of Bell Labs in the U.S. government said there is no public interest, but there is that. And that somehow that it's a battle now. And that this has, I guess, become a piece of the battleground, but there's a whole set of people being disenfranchised by what's happening.
Excuse me, we have traveled long hours and long miles.
Okay.
Could people who have the same point to make over and over make it quickly and not several times? Out of respect for those of us, I'm not the one who comes from the furthest place that I come from far away, who have spent a lot of hours and long nights and long trips, please.
Okay, there are people on the internet and who want to be on the internet who are being disenfranchised, and they have an agreement.
Okay, you are not. Okay, excuse me. Okay, I am the chair, and I am recognizing this gentleman here whom I've not met.
Will Zachman, Canopus Research. If I could just sort of try to take things in a little different direction, let me suggest a perspective, just as a perspective to maybe try out for whatever it's worth for you. And it really is stimulated by Elaine's observations about the unique character of this situation, and I think it is unique in a lot of ways. I'd like to suggest that 100 years from now, there's at least a reasonable possibility that the decisions that are made with regard to this organization, governance thereof, and the mechanisms for membership participation could, conceivably at least, end up being a very significant precedent for the kind of governance structures that are in place on the planet in a century from now. Because what we've got here is something, it's intriguing because technology creates new social forms. And the interesting thing about the internet is that you've got a technology that has run outside of the boundaries of existing governmental structures, of existing regulatory structures, of existing interest group constituencies in a way. And I think that it's at least worth pondering whether there isn't, you know, potential, you know, butterfly effect here that ripples out of this. In that context, that's my general suggestion, okay, as just a perspective. Because it may very well be that we are basically engaging here the kind of questions that are going to eventually become the questions that involve governance of human life on the planet, one way or the other. Now, I will admit to a prejudice of my own going on from that. When I, 30 years ago, used to have these discussions with my friends, some of whom were very much more actively involved politically than I was, because I've never been particularly active politically. That particular debate that I alluded to earlier, that I used to have with a discussion with friends of mine who were involved in one of the more outspoken groups back here in 1969, the Progressive Labor Party, and had this discussion between power to the people versus the vanguard of the proletariat kind of thing, I will unabashedly admit that in that particular one, I always kind of favor the power to the people side of it over the vanguard of the proletariat side of it. I was always in favor of the idea of a bottom-up contributory democracy that had its structures and checks and balances, but that was maximally open. In the context of the potential historical significance of all this, I do sense, and we had in the discussion about threats, when we looked at our threat assessment, and again, I'd urge everybody to do your own, you know, individuals were not considered to be a threat. They were like way at the bottom, 2% threat of the total allocation. Yet there seems to be a pervasive notion somehow that letting individuals loose as members of this somehow is a bad idea. And the particular context there was that somehow that would open the door for, you know, the Chinese government or IBM or Microsoft or whoever to stack the deck, have their all their employees. In the international context, I've pointed out that actually, because there isn't a high level of participation, Denmark could probably take it over if they made a determined effort to do so. But one of the things that always troubled me about those discussions we'd had 30 years ago, and it's something that being within a few mile radius of Harvard Square seems to really create that attitude, is that the very people that I sometimes knew who most said they were in favor of power to the people were the least willing to actually trust the people with the power in their hands. And I would just, in that, trying to evoke that historical context, I just would urge you to consider very seriously that maybe, considering the idea that netizens really are the constituency, recognizing that netizens are at least potentially all the human beings on this earth, that maybe it's worth considering, if not for all nine of the directors at large, having at least some of them, okay, that can be elected by anybody who wants to participate without paying a poll tax, that at least can assure that for some portion of it, that voice will be heard. Because there's no way that the people at large are going to take over this organization. The deck is already stacked in favor of the SOs, and the president alone controls it. You're not going to have a board takeover. And even if you want to take over the board because you have staggered terms and so forth, it takes a while to do it. So my concern is just, even if only as a safety valve, I would strongly urge that whatever the final decision on membership be, that at least some portion of valid representation on the board, if not all nine, some of those nine, truly be available to anybody on the planet who wants to vote on it with minimal requirements for, even if it's only one.
We have an email comment that has been sent in. And what's our procedure for reading email comments? The email has to come to the microphone. So this is it right here? Yeah. Mike.
There are actually many examples of similar organizations. This is an answer to the question, actually, I guess, posed earlier in the day about or that Elaine raised of, you know, do we have any precedent for this kind of hybrid? He says there are actually many examples of similar organizations. What is being done here is hardly unique. It's just coordinating the management of name and address administration, something that is common to almost every communication system in existence. The only basic requirements are to have unique, coherent reference values. There are lots of organizations that have done this over the years. The only difference here is that there are more players and the network is a large-scale, self-organizing, shared user network. Of course, it's always fun to aggrandize one's role. And here are the three such organizations he names. The regional IP address registries are themselves examples of long-standing membership bodies. At the national level, non-governmental membership-oriented administrative bodies have been the prevailing model for coordinating use of third-level domains. And even in the telecom world, at the regional levels, private sector administrative bodies have been the norm. Continuing use of intergovernmental bodies at the global level in that world are the result of legacy arrangements and remain an anachronism today. Oh, wow. And there's some other points that he makes as well that I encourage you to read on the screen. Forgive me, Tony. I know you're out there listening.
My name is Xie Liang. Actually, I came from China, so I'm probably only one from China. Back to the basic, actually, IP address and domain name is the resources. Used to be, we have plenty of that, but right now the supply is not enough. So we have to set a role how to relocate, how to allocate, and how to distribute these resources. And my question is, ICON is a party distribute these resources, or ICON is a party set up a role to how to distribute these resources. So how to balance these powers? Where's the Congress? Where's the Supreme Court? Where's the President? So what my question is, should we only have one party or two or three parties between each other? They can balance, and how to where distribute these resources. And regarding the Chinese government, I think things are too simple. In China, there is a lot of government organizations. Nobody really know who is in charge of who. On the internet, sometimes this site, for example, this site have been blocked. There are panic, and people think, oh, it's too bad for the internet in China. Sometimes they are, Jiang Zemin said, oh, it's, we should promote the internet. Then it's bright in China. Actually, things are very complicated. There is a lot of Chinese users in China. Internet become more and more attached to their daily life. It's not only a government thing. So it's there are 2.5 million internet users in China and in 1998. So internet is in China is not only one thing, it's a very complicated thing. Okay.
I'd like to take your first point and put it to the panel. You use the word distribution of a resource, and I get a sense from the comments of the panel that in fact that's ambiguous between two very different ideas. Scott was suggesting the idea of this body essentially coordinating coordinating following recommendations that have been made from the bottom and worked their ways through to the board. And that doesn't sound so much like a resource that's being distributed, it's just an agreement on protocols. But there's a policy when it, there's a policy question that might also sound like the distribution of resources, where there's a conflict that exists among members of the board, or a conflict exists because the board disagrees with the supporting organization. And in that context, this bottom-up structure does create a problem, a decision problem. And I guess the question is, do we think of the problems that the board will be dealing with more like the first or more like the second? Scott
just
wanted to clarify.
Just clarification. I was speaking specifically that the board doesn't have the power to allocate protocol numbers, but what Gene was talking about was IP addresses, and IP addresses most definitely the rule set for how to allocate IP addresses is certainly part of the coverage of what ICANN has to deal with. There is a set of rules there now, but it's known that it's going to have to be dealt with at some point, and it's part of the specific charge to ICANN to worry about those rules.
Okay, this is a good example then, because in your structure, those rules will be dealt with by the supporting organization feeding a recommendation to the board.
But the board could look at that recommendation and say that it doesn't take into account X, Y, or Z. Other supporting organizations could do the same. Now note that there are two different components of that allocation policy. One is the absolute number of IP addresses, and Jay pointed out that these are not quite as scarce as some people might think. But the routing table space is a scarce resource, and so there's still a scarce resource there. But balancing the needs of expanding the number of people who have addresses under what conditions, and balancing the danger that is to the infrastructure is exactly the sort of thing, the stress that ICANN is going to be placed under.
So it's this balancing of different interests that the board will have to engage.
Yes, the policies that will come up will be a balance of those. The policies will come up from the address supporting organizations will attempt to balance those strains. And it's up to the ICANN board and the other SOs to judge that balance and make a judgment on that balance and decide whether to accept or reject that policy, reject the policy to push it back down and say we don't agree with the balance. So this is exactly a good example.
Okay, but let's just refine it a little bit more. You say they can say we don't accept the balance. What if they say we don't accept the values that you have balanced? Not that your balance is bad, but you're not considering the right values.
I mean, that's equivalent.
Okay, but then the board has the right independently to pick out the values that the supporting organization is supposed to be considering?
The board, and according to the bylaws that are there now, the board can, when presented with a proposal for policy, can reject it on any grounds that it wants to, and provide the reasons for that rejection back to the SO that proposed that.
And the SO can tell them they're full of eggs or whatever they want to do, but at that point becomes the specific time when this conflict, this tension appears. And it's a very good example because we do have exactly that issue where different people have different ideas of how to assign addresses because of the balance of different values. Accessibility, domain, routing table space, running out of addresses, they're all things that are being balanced, and the address support organization balancing in one way, others balance them other ways.
Okay, but this is the type of example that makes me feel like this is not so much bottom-up anymore. If the board has the power to, I seem to have power to get Scott to the mic, much more than I ever thought. If the board has power to say, these are the values, and we're going to not accept a supporting organization's recommendations until you recognize these values.
That is correct.
That sounds like a very important governing function.
In addition, just to be clear on what the current bylaws say that if the supporting organization doesn't provide a proposed policy that the board can accept, the board, in extraordinary circumstances, can create their own policy. So the board has an out to create the policy. But note that if the board creates a policy that the address support organizations don't agree with, mm-hmm. It may be difficult to get the address support organizations to abide by that policy other than the contracts that Jay brought out. And that's going to be an interesting tidbit of the relationship between ICANN and the address support organizations, address registries themselves. There'll have to be some kind of contractual relationship. And under what conditions are they forced to adhere to board-generated policies they don't agree to? There's a nice bunch of tension in here. It's not all roses.
Okay, and just one last clarification. Now, this is a direct requirement that you stay at the mic. Contracts. Now, the two kinds of contracts. You know, I teach contracts. Those are things that courts enforce.
Sorry to have brought them up.
Those are things that courts enforce. But a lot of the, quote, contracts that are being spoken of here, and I think Jay was alluding to some of these, will be basically agreements that get enforced in the very code itself, for example.
Now, they're speaking as a board member of one of the address registries. We expect to have a contract valid in the U.S. between ICANN and ARIN as to how we're going to relate to each other, what we expect of ICANN, what ICANN expects of ARIN, in order to get our allocation of addresses to pass to reallocate to our customers. And I fully expect that sort of thing will be also in place, and this is something Tony Rakowski has mentioned a number of times, that contracts will be in place between ICANN and everybody that it is providing direct services to. And in the case of this address environment, it's anybody who's getting addresses directly from ICANN is going to have some agreement that they're going to follow some set of rules. They're not just going to give them out or throw them away or sell them to Bill Gates or whatever they're going to do. There's got to be some kind of contractual arrangement to say, we will follow a set of rules. And I suspect that will also be the case with all of the domain name registries, too.
Okay. Did you comment here?
Yes. To me, this makes ICANN the organization sound like something that's very established, and that's an international company that has a number of distributors which it has contracted with. Mm-hmm. And that's a very well established and simple structure, and we maybe don't need to delve into a lot of new things to analyze how that works.
I'm sorry, can I just...
Yes, sorry, my name is Johan Hjelman. I'm from Ericsson, Sweden, W3C, and the Web Forum.
I want to ask about your substance of what you said. You're suggesting that when we describe ICANN like this, it sounds very much like existing international organizations.
Multinational. Coca-Cola, yes. For instance. Yeah. They have this type of contracts with the distributors in different countries. Exactly this type. Their contracts regulate very much what the distributors are all allowed to do and not allowed to do. And when they break these contracts, they typically don't get to distribute Coca-Cola anymore. It's as simple as that. So if that's the type of rules we apply, then this is a very simple case. Now, of course, on the governance of ICANN, this makes, if the role of the SOs, as has been sketched here, makes the role of these nine directors at large, even more important that is, it comes from a user community, so that they really speak with the user's voice, because we have the other side, the sort of supplier's voice in the SOs. And this makes the appointment of these directors even more important, that it is determined by a group of users. And in my view, that makes the involvement of user organizations paramount. Finally, a comment to Esther. You might want to appoint an ombudsman as soon as possible for any complaints that might arise. You'll see them pretty soon, I guess. Not necessarily. Well, not from a contractual point of view, it doesn't have to.
At this mic here.
My name is Tom Lowenhaupt, and I'm here on behalf of a community project that I run called the Communisphere Project. And I'm also a member and vice chair of a community board in New York City, a very local level of government. And my comment has to do on a membership issue. Mr. Zachman here had mentioned about having a certain type of representation on the board. And as a community that's not very well wired, I think that you and also a comment that ties in with Ms. Frankel over there, who was saying that referring to a court at some point that will evolve. I was thinking that there should be a means for people who are not on the internet now, or may never be, to be represented on your board. There are people who just, you know, they're Amish and people like that who just, you know, don't want the stuff. There are people who hate it. Those voices have to be heard. Now you govern in a vacuum. You know, you remind me of the whole internet reminds me of Robert Moses coming through my old neighborhood and just ramming this road right down there and saying, you know, it's a good road, you know, and enjoy it. But, you know, they didn't take much consideration to all those people who live there. So, you know, you have to be another type of regulatory agency. You have to open up a little EPA wing when you get a chance also.
I'd like to ask a question, please, because I need to understand. Considering what ICANN's role is, and there is a specific role, what role would the presence of the offline community feel?
I think that everything you do has an impact on the entire society. Everything that's done with the internet has an impact on our entire society. And whereas my mother-in-law doesn't know anything about computers, she comes over these days and sees me playing on that thing, and there's some stock stuff on the screen, and she says, "Watch that, and I want that." And she doesn't know about the internet. You have an impact on her. It has an impact on everybody and everything. And no one watches out for everybody and everything. You watch out for DNSOs and numbers and things like that. And there's a lot more out there. There's a lot of people who don't know. And look at just the people out of here. What is that? 55 people here today. And you're talking about a system that has an impact on everybody. And
I want to push it further. Because I don't know, it's been flowing around on the list already, so I'm trying to really understand. Take it from the other point of view. Regarding ICANN, again, not regarding the whole internet, take an organization that deals with something else than the internet. Why would it come here, and what would it achieve by being a member of ICANN?
Maybe you're right. Maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe there should be a parallel organization. Maybe that, you know, this organization is just, its powers should be recognized as very, very limited, and there should be a second organization that says, well, let's look at what these guys are doing. Let's see what they're up to. You know, what are they doing? How are they doing it? What's the impact of it? There's nobody who does that. As far as I know, I mean, you're taking it away from all the government, our government, just throwing it away. You're saying, it's too hot for me. I don't know anything about it. And I don't know what, you know, most of the governments don't even know it exists.
So. James, let me try to focus this a little bit in this way. We asked James on the panel to help us with this dimension of public interest and how it might interact with this organization. And one response then is there should be a parallel organization, but is there a place here within the ICANN organization for these interests to express themselves?
Well, not being a member of the ICANN organization as it stands right now, being rather new to the organization, I'm not quite sure I'm qualified to answer that question.
What are the questions that you would like ICANN to be considering from the perspectives of, for example, public education that's relevant here?
There are so many, it's hard to know where to begin.
Give us 16.
Give you 16. Do I start with the alphabet soup, access, go down to P and pornography? As a representative of all educators worldwide, how does one answer that question? The way that I understand ICANN, from my own perspective, coming from an academic environment, an academic history, ICANN is entering into a partnership, in essence, with the internet community. And that partnership has certain roles for ICANN and certain responsibilities for both ICANN and its constituency. One of those constituents are educators and children and families and communities or other constituencies. And the responsibilities are varied depending on the role that you have in that partnership. So it's not really a good answer to your question, but I think that once ICANN has fleshed out what those responsibilities pertaining to those different roles are, I think they'll have a better chance of establishing the kind of broad consensus, the kind of trust that you need in this kind of partnership relationship to make it work.
Okay, I've been told that I was mistaken about our ending time, so we were to end at 5 o'clock and it's now 5:15, but I'd like to give any member of the panel an opportunity for a final word if they'd like to take it. Starting from Tamara's side.
I think we've done a lot.
Okay, is it me?
Well, some of the discussions are more or less concentrated on to the potential negative side of or the problematic side of the ICANN or so, but like, you know, what China will do to capture. With all due respect, that I think we should also consider how to further promote the net, that's more of the advancement side. And that's why we are here, and we need more creative thinking for that direction to have more industry or for more activities rather than just stick with all the potentially possible but in reality may not happen in these cases. That's my impression.
Jean?
I am thinking, yes, this is just about names and numbers now, but if you go through the charter, which I did, and now I cannot locate my reference, I'm so sorry. It says something about when you start trying to implement security, when you start getting worried about that, it's all going to get really interesting. And I don't think that the ICANN is going to become just a boring, like, and then you'll say, oh, and it's an administration and there'll be some jobs and they'll labor in obscurity. I think that it's possible that the questions will only become more interesting.
James, do you have a...
I could ramble on if you want me to.
I like the way you rambled before.
Oh, yeah. My students don't. Basically, I guess I could just say from observations that I've actually been tallying some observations that I'll put up on the internet once I've transcribed my illegitimate handwriting. But this regulatory agency, in quotation marks, the decisions that it makes have international implications that have already been talked about at length here, economic, political, social implications. And I think Dave may be right. It may be destined for eventual failure. Or if you want to put a positive spin on it, I think it may be destined for metamorphosis. It may be a caterpillar now, but I think it could turn into a butterfly in time.
Elaine, you started us. Do you want to?
I think because I started you, I'll pass and let you finish.
Okay. Daniel?
just to go back to the boring aspect. I believe the way it exists has been built with a specific and very defined mission, and when the policy aspects are sorted out, it will be boring. Now, maybe ICANN will reinvent itself, but then it will have to reinvent its membership. And so it's basically starting again. And I think we will not solve anything if we try to now to build a membership that's a perfect democracy that does not exist. A democracy needs to fill a role. What is the power that has to be ruled by which people? And just to finish by taking round what Elaine has said, okay, we have that problem and that difficulty. Another way of trying to solve or at least to tackle that difficulty is to consider different categories of memberships, maybe probably voluntary categories and not predefined categories, where people consider themselves as just citizens who vote from time to time and protest from time to time but do not take an active part in policy making, or members, active members. And maybe that would help building up on that kind of a model. It's a maybe, I'm not sure. But maybe that could help us figure out an efficient and also transparent way of doing things.
Well, I do think here we can learn something from the Chinese famous curse, may you live in interesting times. We can say, may Esther and the organization which she's trying to shepherd into existence, may you live in boring times, because that will be a mark of your success, that it has succeeded enough to be boring. I'd like to thank our panelists and everybody who participated for Jonathan has a final comment.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming today. There is a reward for having stayed throughout the entire day. Food much better than the box lunches you got, or maybe didn't get, since you apparently ran out. I saw somebody taking about 5 of them, but I won't name names. That was for the Latin American lunch, I think. But in any event, there is a reception to be had. If I know Charles Nesson, which I feel I do, it will be a very good one. There are directions available to it, both here and downstairs. And it's been incredibly helpful to us to have had this day. And I know, I guess it's even been pointed out, consensus is a big part of it. That's somebody calling me to say, shut up already. Consensus is a big part of it, but the real test, and the real test of even the scheme that we may come up with, or multiple schemes, is how well do the people who have different views and whose views don't prevail in a given decision or a given election, do they feel as if they at least got a fair shake? And that really is the challenge before all of us to come up with this organization. And again, thank you all for coming, and I'll see you at Charlie's. Esther, you have another announcement. This is a bottom-up process. You may go in any direction you like to get to the thing, but food will not be held for you if you make a poor decision.